It's nearly 12 o'clock and time for the KMXT Midday Report. Thank you for listening to KMXT on 100.1 FM. It's your public radio station broadcasting from beautiful downtown Kodiak, Alaska, where it is 64 degrees under mostly sunny skies, northwest winds to 5. For tonight, look for partly cloudy skies, low of about 48. South winds to 5 will become completely calm this evening. And for tomorrow, mostly sunny skies, high near 63, west wind to 5, becoming southeast tomorrow afternoon. Mostly cloudy skies overnight, tomorrow night too, with a low around 53. We're also looking for mostly sunny skies on Friday. Coming up on the Midday Report, elections are coming, and it will be an interesting one for the Kodiak Island Borough. Subsistence chum woes on the Yukon River. And an altered Yukon Quest sled dog races. Those stories and more after national headlines.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. The nation's top defense leaders are disputing reports that U.S. intelligence warned the Afghan government would quickly fall to the Taliban when American troops left. General Mark Milley, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says that while nothing is certain in war, there were no reports he knew of that predicted an Afghan security force of 300,000 would evaporate in 11 days. Milley, who appeared alongside Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, says now the U.S. is laser-focused on evacuations. 4,500 U.S. troops are on the ground at Kabul Airport. The goal is to fly out 5,000 and 9,000 Americans and Afghans per day. But the fate of tens of thousands more people asking for help outside the gates and outside Kabul remains uncertain. NPR's Tom Bowman has more.
The Taliban control those cities now, so can you get out of the city? If you have a car, you're going to go through multiple checkpoints with Taliban. It's going to be difficult, if not impossible, for them to get out. And weeks ago, I talked to an officer in the Pentagon. He said, you know, we're leaving the country. We're now based in Kabul. We're not around the country, so we can't transport them from some of these cities back into Kabul.
NPR's Tom Bowman. The U.S. is facing backlash from several NATO allies over the explosive turn of events in Afghanistan. NPR Scott Detcher reports on President Biden's latest conversation with outgoing German Chancellor Angela Merkel.
Earlier this week, a high-ranking ally of Merkel in German government called Biden's decisions, quote, a serious and far-reaching miscalculation. Still, the White House is framing the call as mostly positive. According to the White House readout of Merkel and Biden's conversation, the two leaders talked about the ongoing evacuation efforts in Kabul and the need to continue humanitarian aid for Afghanistan. It's Biden's second call to a NATO ally following a discussion earlier this week with British Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Meanwhile, the White House also announced that Biden will meet Israel's new prime minister, Naftali Bennett, next week. Bennett replaced Benjamin Netanyahu in June. This will be his first visit to the White House as prime minister. Scott Detrow, NPR News, the White House.
Georgia's Republican-controlled state election board has moved closer to a potential takeover of the elections office in the state's largest, mostly Democratic county, which includes much of Atlanta. From member station WABE, here's Johnny Kaufman.
Democrat and Republican members of Georgia's state election board voted to appoint three people to review the election department in Fulton County. Sarah Tyndall-Gazal is a Democrat on the state election board, and she says the review panel will face political pressure from all sides.
The narrative driving this pressure has been influenced by disinformation surrounding the November 2020 election, but the fact remains that Fulton County voters have reported numerous problems for far longer than November 2020.
The GOP-controlled board could replace Fulton County's Board of Elections with its pick of an administrator. That's possible under Georgia's new controversial voting law passed earlier this year. For NPR News, I'm Johnny Kaufman in Atlanta.
This is NPR News.
Ang NPR Balita ay hatid sa inyo ng Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. Para sa kaukulang impormasyon tungkol sa aming mga serbisyo, tumawag lamang sa 481-2400.
We are still awaiting today's COVID-19 update from the Kodiak Emergency Operations Center. Yesterday, they reported 29 new cases of COVID-19 for the Kodiak Island borough. 20 of those cases were close contacts of previously reported cases, and 9 were classified as community spread. The total currently classified as active locally stands at 124, with 3 cases currently hospitalized. Well, election season is fast approaching for the Kodiak Island borough, and with Dwayne Dvorak and Julie Kavanaugh both stepping down from the borough assembly, it's going to be a little more complicated. Aside from 2 borough assembly seats up for grabs in the election, there are 2 seats open on the school board, 2 on the Bayview Road Service Area Board, 2 on the Fire Protection Area No. 1 Service Area Board, 2 on the Mission Lake Tidegate Service Area Board, 2 on the Menashka Bay Service Area Board, and 2 on the Service Area No. 1 Board, as well as 2 on the Women's Bay Service Area Board. Among the Service Area Board seats, the Bayview Road Service Area Board, Mission Lake Tidegate Service Area Board, Menashka Bay Road Service Area Board, and Women's Bay Service Area Board have no applications for their open seats. The deadline to submit paperwork for to be a write-in for the election is the day before the election, so it's not too late for them to be filled. The borough election is October 5th, making the deadline if you'd like to be a write-in candidate for one of those boards. October 4th, 4:30 p.m. Packets and materials for the application can be found at the borough website or in person at the borough building. For the school board, David Johnson and Judy Karstens have declared candidacy for the 2 open seats. For the Fire Protection Area No. 1 Service Area Board, 3 candidates will compete for 2 open seats, Scott Arndt, Paul Van Dyke, and John Parker. For the 2 seats in the Service Area No. 1 Board, Paul Hansen and Jay Baldwin have announced their candidacies. For the Borough Assembly seats, 7 candidates have so far stepped up to bat. Dennis Simmons and James Turner are the incumbents for the elected seats, and they are being challenged by Sarah Sunston, Eric Sunston, and Scott Smiley. The assembly seats from which Dwayne Dvorak and Julie Kavanaugh are stepping down are a complicated matter. These seats will be filled by applicants, not candidates. Persons interested in filling these seats apply for the position they would like, as they would a job, and are interviewed by the borough assembly. There's a code-mandated timetable for that process. For Dwayne Dvorak's seat, applications are being accepted now through August 20th at 4:30 p.m. Applicants will be interviewed by the Borough Assembly during an August 26th work session, appointed during an executive session of their special meeting on August 31st, and seated on September 2nd. Presently, Jared Griffin and Joseph Delgado have applied for Dvorak's seat. As a disclaimer, Jared Griffin is a member of the KMXT staff. The process is the same for Kavanaugh's seat, only with a staggered schedule. Applications for that seat will be taken August 20th through September 3rd at 4:30 p.m., with applicant interviews to occur the 9th of September. Applicant review and decision in executive session on the 14th of December, and the appointment and oath taking place September 16th. The Borough Assembly is required to interview all applicants for the open assembly positions. Assembly members receive a stipend of $300 per month. Keep tuning in to KMXT and go to kmxt.org for more election coverage. This has been the worst salmon fishing season on record for the Yukon River. King salmon, a regional favorite, has been low for years, but now a typically stable species, chum, has also collapsed. Subsistence fishing on the lower Yukon River for both species is closed. KYUK's Olivia Eberts reports residents who usually depend heavily on fish are pivoting towards other ways to get meat.
I started fishing on the Yukon when I was about 6 years old. There's one point, me and my grandpa were coming down here for supplies, and we had a summer chum jump into the boat. But those days are gone.
Jason Lamont from Eumonic lives off of subsistence food. And in past summers, that's meant salmon. His family doesn't buy meat from the store. The salmon caught during the summer would help carry his family through the winter.
when we were doing subsistence, we'd get, you know, 300 fish, and we can get that usually in about 2-3 hours. Nowadays, in our freezer, we have only one fish so far, and we're lucky to have it.
Elder Herman Hooch also relies on subsistence food. Like Lamont, Hooch is from Mnemonic, near the Yukon River mouth.
We learned from our parents that store-bought goods are not healthy.
Neither Hooch nor Lamont has been able to subsistence fish for chums or kings on the Yukon this year. Subsistence fishing for the species has been closed all season. In order for state fishery managers in Alaska to open subsistence fishing, a certain number of chum salmon first need to be counted on the river. Normally, that number is met, no problem. On average, the run size is 1.7 million summer chum. But last year, the run suddenly dropped to less than half that. And this year, the number dropped again to less than a tenth of the average run size. So Herman Hooch and Jason Lamont are missing a big part of their diet. And to make up for lost protein, they're going to some pretty extreme lengths.
I had to go 100 miles up north just to go get my subsistence needs.
Hooch traveled to the Norton Sound area to harvest chum this summer. But the numbers weren't great there either. According to a state fishery biologist, chum numbers have been dismal all over the Bering Sea area since last year. But at least subsistence fishing was open in Norton Sound. So Hooch made that journey.
That first trip I went, I didn't have any luck.
The second time, he did have some luck. He caught about 100 chum. He estimates each round trip cost $500. That means, with all the expenses added up, each chum cost him about $10. It was expensive, but cheaper than groceries in Mnemonic. And he wasn't the only one trying his luck there.
What surprised me this year was the whole delta of the Yukon was at Norton Sound. We seen hundreds of nets up there, and they said, holy cow, that's the first time that this ever happened.
Jason Lamont has also ventured into new waters. He's been taking his river-going skiff out into the testy waves of the Bering Sea.
There's a small group of us who are crazy enough to go out there and start harvesting food.
But they're not targeting salmon. They're going for cod and learning in real time what ocean fishing entails. Lamont says he takes his boat sometimes as far as 50 miles off the coast. Most boats that go out that far are several times larger than his small skiff.
And we go out there to the same size ocean, but the storms are the same too.
But Lamont is determined to not give up on his Yupik culture's subsistence traditions.
You got to either adapt or lose it.
3 hours upriver by skiff, in the community of St. Mary's, folks don't have the same option to travel all the way out to Norton Sound. Instead, they're supplementing their diet with extra groceries, more whitefish, and they'll try to bag extra game meat. At the St. Mary's Boat Harbor, Bay and Waukee Johnson are on their way out to pick berries. Theirs is one of the only skiffs leaving the harbor that day. The rest of the boats bob along the shore, empty of fishing gear. I ask the couple how they'll fill their pantry this winter.
We're going to go after other species of fish.
Definitely birds. More moose. We hope to get fall chum, but I doubt it. We didn't see any last summer, so I doubt if we'll see any this summer either.
The state has no plans to open subsistence fishing for fall chum. The run reached its midpoint this month, and the numbers are twice as low as last year. In St. Mary's, I'm Olivia Eberts.
And here is the most recent update from the Kodiak Area Emergency Services Organization regarding today's new cases of COVID-19. 5 new cases have been reported for the Kodiak Island Borough. All 5 were tested yesterday. 4 of the cases are close contacts of previously reported cases. 1 is classified as community spread. As of today, 122 cases are classified as active locally, and there are 5 active cases currently hospitalized in Kodiak. The emergency room remains busy with patients seeking care for COVID-related symptoms. A commercial plane was damaged in flight between Fairbanks and Hoosley on Monday.
It was a significant event, and obviously the NTSB would be investigating to see what the cause was.
The National Transportation Safety Board Alaska Region Chief Clint Johnson says the Wright Air Service Cessna Caravan carrying a pilot and 8 passengers was on a scheduled run to Huslia Monday afternoon when it experienced trouble.
The airplane was level at 10,500 feet in cruise, and we understand that there was an upset, a significant drop in altitude. Pilot was able to regain control of the airplane, subsequently made an emergency landing back in Fairbanks. However, there was substantial damage to the airplane.
A social media post by a passenger says the single engine plane, quote, twirled upside down twice, close quote, and photos of the plane on the tarmac in Fairbanks show a bent aileron on the aircraft's right wing. A Fairbanks International Airport spokesperson says that the aircraft was met by emergency response vehicles as a precaution, but reportedly landed safely and no one was injured. Wright Air Service declined an interview request, but said they are happy no one was hurt and with how their pilot handled the situation. Opening day to sign up for the 2022 pandemic-altered Yukon Quest Sled Dog Races is Saturday. As KUAC's Dan Bros reports, the traditional 1,000-mile international race will not happen for the second year in a row, but there will be shorter events on either side of the Alaska-Yukon border.
The Quest organization's Alaska and Yukon boards decided earlier this summer to run independent events in February 2022, and the Yukon side previously announced a plan to hold 100- and 300-mile events. The Alaska side board finalized its own plan at a recent meeting. Board member and race marshal Doug Grillo says it includes two races, starting with a 550-miler.
It's going to go from Toke to Chicken to Eagle, and then our standard trail from Eagle to Circle to Central to Mile 101, Two Rivers, and it'll finish in Fairbanks. And that's going to start on the 5th of February. And in conjunction with that, on the 7th of February, we're planning on starting a 200-mile race starting in Circle, which will go the standard route and finish in Fairbanks at about the same time frame as the 550.
There was only one Quest race this past winter, a 300-miler that started in Fairbanks and finished in Central. Grillo says even with the recent reopening of the Alaska-Yukon border, too many uncertainties remain to put on the traditional 1,000-mile international event in 2022.
The border's open for, you know, some tourism if you're vaccinated. There'd be a whole other story, I think, to get permission to stage the kind of event we want to stage.
Grillo says a survey of mushers earlier this year also found many would not participate if the 1,000-mile race was held.
And I think it's a combination of people's finances and what they actually got to do last year for qualifiers and stuff. I think it's a whole perfect storm kind of that we're kind of looking at for 2022. So that played, you know, a big part in the decision.
Grillo says the Alaska and Yukon Quest boards are maintaining a good relationship and are encouraging mushers to compete on both sides of the border.
We're having the Yukon Quest Cup this year, which is going to be really interesting because the Yukon is doing two races of their own, and we've got a fairly elaborate point system set up to encourage mushers to try to run, you know, a race from each side of the border and get points. Then we'll try to have an overall champion if that happens.
Grillo says the Quest Cup is an attempt to maintain some continuity between the races Alaska and Yukon boards, as the goal is to return to a normal race format in 2023.
That is certainly everybody's plan. That's the goal we're going towards for 2023. There's no discussion to make any of this permanent.
Yukon Quest organizers in Fairbanks and Whitehorse are holding opening day sign-up events Saturday afternoon. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Former Alaska Governor Bill Walker announced yesterday that he's running for governor again. Walker says Alaskans feel the state is broken.
It's really a matter of fixing Alaska. It's about rebuilding trust. You know, rebuilding relationships, so we can move on out of this the deficit we've been in since 2012.
Walker has teamed up with former state labor commissioner Heidi Dreigas, who is campaigning to be his lieutenant governor. They will run as nonpartisans, But with Alaska's new open primary, Walker will be head-to-head against Republican Governor Mike Dunleavy on the primary ballot next August. The top four candidates from the primary will advance to the general. Walker was governor from 2014 to 2018. Alaska's fiscal crisis predated him, and he didn't solve it. But he says he reduced the deficit from $4 billion to about $1 billion and got the legislature to pass a bill setting guidelines on the use of the permanent fund earnings to pay for government.
We ran out of time to close the last quarter of the deficit. But, you know, we were working collaboratively with the legislature.
Walker ran for a second term in 2018. His then running mate, Lieutenant Governor Byron Mallott, resigned amid reports that he had made an inappropriate overture to a woman. Walker suspended his campaign days later. Mallott died in May of last year.
Today's KMXT Local News is brought to you in part by Discover Kodiak, a one-stop source for visitor information on Kodiak and other destinations around the state. On the web at kodiak.org and at the Visitor Center in the Ferry Terminal Building at 100 Marine Way, 486-4782.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Lights on fishing gear greatly reduce bycatch. More after this.
Grundin's new Deck Boss boots give you better grip, better comfort, and happier feet. Made in the USA.
Bycatch gives Alaska's otherwise stellar fisheries management its biggest black eye. A simple fix comes in the form of programmable LED lights on fishing gear.
You can really have a good degree of control over what you're putting into fishing gear. So, for instance, green light is really effective for reducing turtle bycatch and gill nets. Blue light flashing at a particular rate can deter haddock and drive them away from a light, for instance. You can use it for a number of different species and in different circumstances as well.
Dan Watson is CEO and co-founder of Safety Net Technologies, based in the UK, which, since 2015, has provided its Pisces light system to fisheries around the globe. The 10 lights are powered by a wireless charger, require no plugs or batteries, automatically turn on underwater only when needed, and they don't weaken or weigh down nets.
It's not like you're having to cover, for instance, the entire panel of a fishing gear. It might be that you put them along the foot rope or the headline or even potentially in the wings or around a square mesh panel, for instance. So we generally supply fishing vessels with around 10 lights, so a kit of 10 lights and a couple of charging cases to keep them going. I mean, it might be that a vessel needs 20 lights, and rather than sort of like hundreds of lights, we're talking sort of in the order of tens.
In the gillnet fishery in Peru, the Pisces lights reduced bycatch of sea turtles by over 70%, 66% for dolphins and porpoises, and 85% for seabirds. A study last year by the Pacific States Marine Fisheries Commission showed the lights directed nearly 90% of Chinook salmon bycatch to escape panels and trawl nets in the hake fishery. And since 2018, Oregon has required that lights are used on shrimp trawls, and it's cut takes of eulachon by over 90% and rockfish by 78%. In all cases, the target catches were not reduced. Since May, his team has been collaborating with the Alaska Ocean Cluster to bring the light show to Bering Sea trawlers. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Hello, this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in Kodiak with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement number 36, date issued 10 a.m. on August 17th. There will be a 54-hour commercial salmon fishing period in the mainland district from noon Wednesday, August 18th until 6 p.m. Friday, August 20th. There will be a 30-hour commercial salmon fishing period in the inner Iqaluit section of the Southwest Kodiak District from noon Wednesday, August 18th until 6 p.m. Thursday, August 19th. Waters will be open to the stream terminus of Iqaluit River, stream number 256201. As previously announced, there will be a 30-hour commercial salmon fishing period in the Duck Bay section of the Afognak District from noon Tuesday, August 17th until 6 p.m. Wednesday, August 18th. And there will be a 78-hour commercial salmon fishing period in the Northeast Kodiak District from noon Tuesday, August 17th, until 6 p.m. Friday, August 20th. There will be a 69-hour extension to the current commercial salmon fishing period from 9 p.m. Tuesday, August 17th, until 6 p.m. Friday, August 20th, in the following areas. In the Northwest Kodiak District, the Southwest Afognak section of the Afognak District, the Outer Aikuluk section of the Southwest Kodiak District, the Cape Alatak, Humpy Dead Man, Alatak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alatak District, and the Sicalitic, Two-Headed, and Seven Rivers sections of the Eastside Kodiak District. Closed waters are reduced until further notice at Humpy Cove to the stream terminus of Humpy Creek, stream number 257701, and to the stream terminus of 257703 as well. The Spiridon Bay Special Harvest Area, also known as Telrod Cove, remains open to commercial salmon fishing until further notice. And cost recovery fisheries have begun at Katoy Bay Special Harvest Area, and fishing opportunities in the Duck Bay, Izuit Bay, and Inner and Outer Katoy Bay sections will depend on the ability to meet KRAA cost recovery needs, and all cost recovery information may be obtained by calling 486-6559. Until further notice, in that portion of the Northwest and Southwest Kodiak District south of a latitude of Cape Kuliak, king salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse seine gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Other closed waters are shown in the Kodiak Area Salmon Statistical Chart and detailed in commercial salmon fishing regulations and statistical charts. Harvest strategies and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game Office. And, of course, the most recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour recorder phone at 486-4559. Thank you very much. Good luck fishing. And this is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game.
And here is your Island Messenger for Wednesday. It is the 18th day of August, the year 2021. The sun rose at 6:41. It won't set again until 9:43, giving us 15 hours and 3 minutes of daylight, a loss of 4 minutes and 44 seconds compared to yesterday. Our record low for this day was 40, set in 1966, and our record high was 74. That was set in 1944, 1999, and 2019. 64 degrees right now. Very pleasant day. Mostly sunny skies. Northwest winds to about 5. Partly cloudy skies overnight with a low around 48. South winds will become completely calm this evening and give way to mostly sunny skies tomorrow. High near 63 tomorrow. Looking at our local tides, we just had a high tide here on the east side at 12:14. That was a 5.9-foot tide. Not too big. Our next low tide won't be very low either, 4:53 p.m., a 3.4-foot tide, followed by a high tide at 11:19 p.m. of 9.1 feet, and then our morning low tide here on the east side will be at 6:36 a.m. and be minus 0.4 feet. Over on the west side, and this is Larsen Bay, your next high tide is just about to happen, 12:29 p.m., 10-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 5:54 this afternoon of 5 feet. And then your next high tide will be almost midnight, 11:52 p.m., 13.6 feet, followed by a low tide tomorrow morning on the west side at 7:03 a.m., minus 1 foot. Mariners, here is your forecast for Marmot Island to Sitkanat, Kodiak's east side offshore, west 15 right now, seas to 7 feet. For tomorrow, southwest 20, seas to 6 feet. Over in the Shelikof, variable 10 right now, seas to 3 feet. For tomorrow, southwest 20, seas to 3 feet, building to 6 feet tomorrow afternoon in the Shelikof. The City of Kodiak and Kodiak Island Borough Cooperative Relations Committee is holding a meeting today at 4 p.m. in the Kodiak Public Library's multi-purpose room. That meeting is open to the public, and agendas and meeting packets are available online at the City of Kodiak website. To request paper copies of the packet or additional information, call the city clerk at 486-8636. The next meeting of the Kodiak Public Broadcasting Board of Directors is Thursday, tomorrow, 6 p.m., via video conference. If you'd like to attend the meeting, please contact Jared Griffin at jared@kmxt.org. That's jared@kmxt.org, or give us a call at the station at 486-3181 for link information. The public is welcome to attend.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.